There we go. Oh, yeah. Now I hear myself.
Is that good?
Yeah, I can hear you too.
Okay, great.
Excellent.
Okay, so who are you?
I'm Dennis Pilon. I'm an associate professor of political science at York University.
And
I can tell you more.
Yeah, do more.
Well, you know, I mean, I came from a very political family. You know, I came from that kind of family where, you know, you could be on one side of the post, but you know, if you weren't on the right side of the post, you know, you'd be out the door, right?
Was it the right side?
No, it was the left side.
It was the left side.
I came from a very working class background in British Columbia, which is a very interesting, divided polity.
I'm from BC, too.
Oh, well.
From Vancouver. Where are you
from? Same here, East Van.
East Van.
East Vancouver.
I'm from West Van.
Oh.
But
wow.
don't
don't hate you.
Everybody's like, oh. But it was the 70s, man. It was cheaper than Kits.
It's true. It was different.
My dad was a high school teacher. It was no big deal.
It has changed a lot. Definitely.
A lot.
Definitely. And, you know, there used to be a better mix of classes the different burbs. Though, I mean, you know, if you go back to West Van's origins, it was a very working class community, logging communities. Mm-hmm. You know, you go back to the 20s and 30s.
Although there was a covenant until in the 30s where they didn't allow Jewish people, black people. It was also very white.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, those were interesting times.
But as soon as I could, I moved to East Van.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, I didn't have any choice. I mean, that's that's where you go.
It's a street cred. It's also the affordable community, or it was.
It was, yeah. And it was so much fun being a broke actor, living off of the drive in a shitty apartment. In not a crack house, but a house where crack was done.
Right, right. Crack had a history.
Yeah, I have fond memories of East Van.
You know, when I was a very small child, we used to live on Commercial Street.
Oh, I know where that is. Hold on. Commercial Street. It's down at like the north end of Commercial Drive, right? It's with the high school on it?
No, it's got a right at the end of it, there's an elementary school, Lord Selkirk Elementary School. But basically, it's where Commercial Drive turns into Victoria Drive. You know, when you drive up Commercial Drive, it makes this big turn, and it basically cuts off Commercial Drive and takes over. Well, the bit that's left over is Commercial Street. And I lived there when there was a cookie factory, a pie factory, and a donut factory. I mean, talk about cashing in as a kid, right? This was great.
And that's so like working class. You're surrounded by industry.
Yep. Yeah. No, that was food industry. I mean,
food industry.
It was not like the coal mines or something. I mean, you know.
No.
It's terrible. Those cookies. We had to get those broken cookie boxes that were on sale. My mother would always get.
I'm having such a nostalgic moment here for Vancouver.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And so you grew up in Libby Davies territory.
Absolutely. East Van, Trout Lake. I went to Gladstone. My parents went to Gladstone. Very Italian and British working class neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
So that's where your left wing bent. Came from.
That was the culture. Very much the culture. And my grandfather was a union organizer. You know, my grandparents' kind of leftism goes way back
Did you ever rebel against it?
No, I mean, I grew up with it. It was part of my identity about who we were.
Didn't Alex P. Keaton that during your formative years?
No. We didn't have enough money to. We weren't middle class enough to do that, right? My dad was a truck driver and he operated machinery in mines. That wasn't where we came from. That wasn't where we were.
So how's the left doing now?
Well,
are you a liberal or an NDPer? Provincially.
I mean, I've always been a lifelong NDPer. You know, as
me too.
I could never vote for anyone else. My grandfather would be like, you could vote for someone to the left of the NDP, but you know, anything else was fighting talk. But I'm not a member of any party, and when I do the kind of media commentary, you know, I give everybody guns blazing, right? I try to sort of explain things in a way that, you know, anybody can get into the conversation. That's what I see my
this
role
is,
as.
To me, this is what I'm most interested in, is the nonpartisan, where is everyone screwing up? I don't understand how people are voting for Doug Ford, this irrational, irate reaction that gets you nowhere.
Yeah. Well, I can explain why some people think, you know, Doug Ford or Rob Ford are attractive, and there's lots of complications. I mean, for some, of course, it's strictly self-interest. The Fords are reliably right-wing, and in some ways extremely right-wing on the economic front. So in that sense, they have very powerful funders who back them. So that helps them.
And
right?
Who are those guys?
Oh, gosh. You know, we'd have to go through a list. I don't have it with me today. But, you know, it's, you know, Fortune 500 kind of people, right?
And why do they think that the Fords who haven't proven anything with business or politics would be good for them because they could push them around.
Well, you know, part of it is reliability, right? Part of the reason that, for instance, corporate Canada never will be comfortable with the NDP, despite the fact that the party doesn't represent any kind of crazy leftism at all, they're fairly mild in their views, is because they don't have a way into the party. Right, the Liberals and the Conservatives, corporate Canada knows those people. They went to school with them. They went to law school with them. I mean, they can get on the phone. They can get a hold of somebody who makes decisions. They can't do that with the NDP, and so that makes the NDP, no matter what they say, not reliable.
But there's plenty of NDP lobbyists would take jobs with Fortune 500.
Of course,
they would help them.
Absolutely, and this is the silliness, right? Is that often? I mean, what we're going to see now in the Ontario election is a ramping up of the kind of Cold War rhetoric, the red baiting. You know, gosh, you know, the sky's going to fall economically if you elect the NDP, when in fact the NDP are offering a pretty moderate platform with slightly more social justice content, which obviously would be very good to the people who need those policies, but there's nothing, you know, terribly radical about what the NDP
are offering. Do those people vote?
Well, that is part of the problem, right? When we look at the electorate, the people who need politics the most participate the least. And there's all kinds of reasons for that I think are worth discussing. You know, we hear that the reason that people don't vote is because they're too busy on their devices or, you know, they're down, you know, at the pub having some drinks and, you know, they don't care, right? When in fact, there's some really fascinating research that's been done that suggests that poor and working people don't vote because they don't feel entitled to vote. You know, they've been surrounded by a discourse that says that, you know, if you're not educated, I mean, if you don't know everything, then you shouldn't participate. And they really feel profoundly that they don't know everything. And what's interesting is that when you gauge their knowledge, like when you do tests of their knowledge, turns out they know as much about politics as middle-class people do. The difference is middle-class people have a higher sense of entitlement.
I'm picturing being asked about my apathy. And I think my response would be, and has been, and I'm hoping that this is reflective of working-class people, if I'm not that, it's boring. I can't read this. This is dull. This is boring. Kathleen Wynne is boring. Andrea Horvath is boring. I mean, the other day when she was reacting to the new Doug Ford scandal about memberships. Oh my God.
Couldn't we get
a little more teeth?
Where's some sex and sizzle?
Yeah.
This is a drive-by.
Jump on this. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Both barrels, but there was nothing. So if there was somebody who could actually talk with some passion, short sentences, I would respond to that.
Well, in a way, that's part of the reaction of the Fords, right? Part of the reaction from some to the Fords is their authenticity. That's what they're selling. Right, people. Trump. I mean, we may not see Trump as authentic, but there are people who do because he appears to speak out of turn. Mm-hmm. He says things that the elites don't want to hear. He doesn't act in a very, you know, prissy middle class way where everything is so nicey.
There's no talking points.
And you know, he makes
talking points are the death.
And he makes mistakes. Right, he says wrong things. And you know what? There's a lot of people who say wrong things, and they identify with him because he screws up. Right. And that was the problem with Ford was, you know, these people kept piling on Rob Ford when he was mayor. And I kept saying to people, you're just making him more popular. Because the more he screws up, the more he appeals to people who screw up. And there's a lot of people out there who screw up. There's a lot of people out there who feel like they're a failure.
Yeah. And now, so makes sense if you're looking for friends. Politically, I still have this, and I'm not smarter than anyone. I'm mildly educated. I am middle of the road. I still want somebody better than me in charge. What's with this Stockholm syndrome?
We see that's an old school set of ideas, right? You go back to the mid-century when we had very high voter turnout. I mean, what's interesting about
what you, was how high was it?
Well,
what
it was
it like
80%, right?
Really?
80% voter turnout. And what's interesting is that the voters who are missing are the poor and working class. They've fallen out of the electorate. Here's a little factoid, right? Kids at university, we've dramatically increased their voter turnout. Youth, if they're at university, are turning out to vote like nobody's business. The problem is the gains have been erased by poor and working class kids who aren't voting. That means that in the past, poor and working class kids were voting. Why? Well, part of the reason was it was a more polarized polity. It was divided on this left and
right.
What
does polity mean?
Polity, the political world, right? You know, the space in which we talk about politics, the polity, sorry, jargon alert. So you go back to the 40s and 50s, and it's left versus right, it's class struggle, you know, it's anti-corporate, pro-corporate, pro-business, anti-business. You know, people could get a piece of this action without a PhD. And that's where you're talking about boring. That's part of it, right? In the past, the way in for politics was the ideological polarization. And part of the problem is that all our parties have become very middle class in their discourse, in their way of talking. And that's boring. I mean, but it's safe. The chances of making a mistake, the chances of having the media blow up your comment is less in a situation where everybody's saying nice things and using nice language.
Doesn't that create an opportunity for a Hugo Chavez to come along and just blow things up?
It could. And, you know, the best person who's done that is Jeremy Corbyn in the UK for the Labour Party. Now, Jeremy's not a firestorm. You know, no one's going to say they're terribly excited. But he does come off as authentic. And what was interesting about what happened in the last British election was that the media had beat on him and said he was this terrible, fire-breathing, you know, leftist. And then he was on TV and on these chat shows during the election, and people got to see him, and it was like, I don't know, seems like a nice guy, you know? Seems ordinary,
yeah.
You know, seems concerned about yeah. people like me. I mean, it just blew up in their faces. And so, you know, yes, in a way there's an opening, but left-wing parties, because the media don't treat the different parties the same. You know, let's go back to the last federal election, right? Everybody goes on about how Justin Trudeau ran to the left of the NDP. Well, mm-hmm. he can do that because the media know they can reel him in after the election, right? After the elections, the Liberals will abandon most of those ideas. On the other hand, the NDP might actually do those things, and that's dangerous. So Thomas Mulcair saying he would run a deficit, oh, that's terrible. But Justin Trudeau can say it, nobody blinks an eye. So that's part of the problem. It's not surprising to see Doug Ford and Rob Ford come out with these, you know, blustering statements and kind of populism and get away with it in a way that it's harder for a left-wing candidate.
It still is frustrating, the double standard. How do you combat it?
Well, okay, if we look at Europe, we see a lot of kind of firebrand populists on the left emerging, right? Podemos in Spain, there's a whole bunch of different groups that have been, you know, across the different European countries. And part of the reason they can do that is because they use a different voting system. They use what's called proportional representation. So if your party gets 20% of the votes, you get 20% of the seats, right? We use a system called first past the post, where basically in each riding, it's a winner-take-all, fight-to-the-death fight. One person wins. No matter right. how many people vote against
them. If you get 50% of the vote plus one, you've won it all.
You don't even need 50% plus one. If there's three people running, you right. could win the riding with 34% of the
vote. Which system's better?
Well, PR is way better, way more democratic.
What's PR?
Proportional representation.
Right.
So what?
And that's what the Liberals were promising to do.
That's right, federally.
Yet that's one right. one more thing they flip-flopped on.
Exactly. And so, you know, part of the why we can see a greater range of opinions and a little more excitement in some of these European elections is because they have a system where if people vote for it, they get it. But in our system, it's very hard for new ideas to break in because basically people are always stuck with the strategic dilemma.
Do right. they have, right, strategic voting?
Exactly, because if you let's say there's an exciting person who's come out, you want to vote for them, but then mm-hmm. you think, oh, I'm going to throw away my vote because yeah. maybe they don't have a chance of winning, or maybe their votes are too spread out across the country. The Green Party, good example, right? We had an election a couple elections ago. The Greens got almost 1 million votes federally, didn't elect anybody because it was too spread out across the country. Now, if those had all been in one riding, they would have won, right? So that's the problem.
PR countries, do they have more parties?
They do. They do tend to have more parties.
Because it encourages?
Well, it doesn't encourage it. It allows it, right? You know, in some countries, some PR countries have a lot of parties. Some don't, right? Austria has a PR system. They got 3-4 parties. Mm-hmm. You know, Holland has got, you know, 5, 6, 8 parties.
Germany has a ton.
Germany doesn't. For the longest time, ever since the post-war period, Germany had 3 parties, typically. And then in the 80s, the Green Party broke in. Now I think they have 5 parties in their parliament. So Germany's not a good example. But they use a PR system.
So bringing it back to this province, how is the NDP doing so far?
Shockingly well. And
you're shocked.
Well, I am. I mean, I think
she didn't do much, it seemed.
It seems that, you know, she wasn't offering much that was terribly different. Though I would say this. I think that the policies that the NDP came out with this time were much more effectively targeted towards their own audience. And it just so happens that by doing that, they've actually appealed to a broader audience, right? They've always operated through this strategic voting idea that they need to move to the center, right? No, no, we need to be kind of like the liberals, but different, but not different.
Is that what, sorry to interrupt, is that what Tom Mulcair was doing when he said, I'm going to balance the budget and take care of everybody?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what he was trying to do, because the dominant discourse in the media is that you must do this, you must do that, and if you don't...
And the libs were going to run a deficit, so now he didn't have any more real estate. He was in a corner. He had to do something, and that worked with me. I thought, that's a great idea. I don't know if it's possible, but I'm going to vote NDP for that reason. Whereas, from what I've heard, people in the know were like, You just tanked. That's the whole NDP ideology. You just went against our core thing.
You know, the NDP is a coalition like every party. Every party is a coalition of elements. All different people are involved. You know, it's totally false to say that the NDP is a socialist party, but it's just as false to say that there aren't socialists in the party, right? The NDP has got a mix of people who get involved. Some are small-L liberals. Some are old-fashioned PCs who got nowhere to go. Some of them are communitarians and group huggers and all kinds of people, right? In the same way that the liberals are a coalition of soft-left liberals and hard-right economic liberals.
And so the Andrea Horvath is now riding this wave.
So what Horvath has done is she has said, you know, we are going to invest in the province. We are going to do a whole bunch of things that people generally expect the NDP to do, which is support hospitals and education, move towards more equality of wealth, you know, make the rich pay their fair share. These are classic, you know, left-wing ideas. And what the NDP appears to have discovered is there's a much broader appetite for those policies than they thought.
Is that because people don't want to vote for Ford? Well, there's liberals out there that are like, I can't do that. I guess I'll...
It's a perfect storm, right? It's a perfect storm that has worked in Andrea's favor. If Patrick Brown were the leader and all of his creepiness hadn't come out, you know, I think they'd be cakewalking their way to victory right now.
It's true. It's true, isn't it? I mean, this week at least, the PCs have to be thinking, oh, if only we had Patrick Brown.
If only we'd kept our mouths shut. But so, you know, I think what's happened is that as much as the media are generally biased to the right, well, to put it this way, the media are biased on economic issues to the right. They're biased to the left on social issues. So the media tend to be very pro-abortion, you know, pro-gay rights, you know, perceived as very left-wing issues. But on economic issues, they're very right-wing.
Can I just interrupt again? I'd love
it's the
to
only
come
way to
up...
get a word in edgewise. So absolutely, do it.
I'd love to come up with a different term other than like pro-abortion. Like
pro-choice.
I'm pro-choice.
Yes.
But I want the people that are pro-life to know that pro-choice doesn't mean we're anti-life, doesn't mean people are going around going, I love abortion. I always think about that when I hear that on the news.
You know,
I'm like, you got to couch it differently.
Well, I mean, you know, the point, the issue that I put to people who are pro-life in a way that they want to deny a woman an opportunity to choose, I say to them, well, I think, you know, there's a way to pursue your agenda, and that is to make sure that women are in control of the decisions that affect their bodies, and so then they won't need an abortion. Right? That's
right.
The place we want to be. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, nobody's going to have sex, and let's talk about sex, and let's not have abortions. It's like, no, if you don't want abortions, then let's work to a world where no one will ever need one. And the place to do that is to have people say, I've got birth control, I don't want to have sex right now, I'm not going to make poor choices. Yeah. You know?
I like that.
And then
that's
we all
great.
Win.
Okay, two old white guys talking about women's rights.
Absolutely.
I love it.
We got it all sorted.
What were you talking about before I interrupted you?
So this division between, you know, in the way the media responds, you know, they're very economically right wing. They tend to be socially left wing. And so what's happened for the NDP is a perfect storm, right? Normally the media, no matter what is happening, will fall behind the two corporate parties, the Liberals and the NDP. The problem is that they've been bashing Wynne all this time. You know, everybody's got a sense that this government is exhausted. And then here come the PCs. And here they come. Whoa, what a disaster. What a gong show, right? I mean, there's a certain point at which the media does need to maintain its credibility. And so for them to step forward and say, we believe that Doug Ford is the best choice. I mean, they just can't do it with a straight face, right? Not with all of the legion of problems and all of this, you know, scandal. And even they are having difficulty. They just can't do it. And that's so that's where it's really worked in the NDP's favor, in part because, you know, for instance, let's say that there was that gaffe the NDP had with the budgeting of their platform, and they discovered an error. Now, normally, you know, the media would just descend on that, drop an atom bomb, and be the, you know, end of war type on the front of the newspaper, you know, NDP, idiots with the economy. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the PCs haven't put out anything. They haven't put out any policies.
Now, why is that a problem? I mean, I thought they played that well by, we won't say anything. We'll just play defense. We came out with all the, we came out with a 100-point lead.
Because there is a common sense fairness that, you know, I mean, there's ideologues out there. There's partisans who, it's my party, do or die, you know, no matter what happens. Adolf Hitler could be the leader. They'll still vote for it, you know. But the rest of the voters are not so strict. And they are affected by perceptions of things. And they, at a certain point, are going to say, you know what, this doesn't pass the smell test. And the media, who proclaim that they are this neutral, you know, objective source, they can push something that's pretty odious, but only so far. And then they start to reveal, you know, their bias, which, of course, they work very hard to keep hidden.
Can the NDP sustain this lead? Or are the trend lines going to keep going up? Do you wish? Do we wish that this was happening maybe a week in the future and not now?
You know, I hear a lot of people say that maybe they're peaking too early. In fact, people have been saying that ever since, you know, the election started.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, to me, unless the qualitative reality of Doug Ford changes, the more the man opens his mouth, it appears that he's in trouble. And that's where, you know, a lot of people had said to me, oh, you know, Rob Ford, Doug Ford, you know, they're going to run provincially. And I'd said to them, it's a different ballgame. You know, at the municipal level, it's like the Wild West. Anything goes. Any kind of craziness can happen.
There's nut jobs that run for mayor.
And there's no accountability, right? I mean, you can get in there, you can mouth off. Who cares, right? Because there's no party discipline. There's no need. There's no legislative discipline. You know, you don't have to sustain a government.
Right. You don't. Okay, let's explain that to me. You don't need a party. You
That's
can
right.
just be a lone wolf living in the beaches who loves raccoons.
Yep, exactly. And in a way, that was Rob Ford. I mean, he was a mayor who really could do very little because he was so bad at the retail side of the politics. He just wasn't good at rolling the logs and getting people to do what he wanted. He was great at bashing out, you know, headline-grabbing slogans and speaking off the cuff and saying things you don't normally hear politicians say. And that made his supporters really happy. But he didn't get much done.
Can a leopard change their spots? Like, can Andrea Horvath, although now with her lead, maybe she doesn't want to say anything. Maybe when you're in the lead, you stop saying stuff. But can, like, what about Wynn? Can't she throw a Hail Mary pass? Can she stop with the boringness and like show up in the leather outfit, tough grandma, fucking hard-ass lesbian. Sorry, there's Jesse. He's a young kid. He's listening to me swear. Can you change those stripes and like make a splash?
It wouldn't seem authentic. You know, part of what you're selling in politics is what people want to believe about you. Right? You don't control how everyone sees you, right? Somebody sees you, hey, he's a good-looking guy with his fabulous blonde locks, and like, whoa, right? They're already deciding who you are.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go, no, I'm ugly inside. They're not going to buy it, right?
And it's I've been saying that for years.
And it's the same with Kathleen Wynne. Sure, she could put on the leather and ride the motorbike down, you know, straight from the Dyke March, but nobody would buy it, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I guess I want... I guess I want her to acknowledge that this isn't going well. She should have stepped aside, as Brad Levine on the last episode said. She should have stepped aside when their polling numbers like a year ago weren't doing well. They should have found another leader to run this campaign. She could have come out and gone, "Hey, well, I've done all this great work. See you later." It was fun, and she would have her legacy intact. Now...
Yeah, her legacy is going to be the destruction of the party. You know, what I try to remind people is that Wynne, in some sense, didn't really win, you know, in the last election. She was not that popular. Mm-hmm. You know, 38% of the popular vote is a very low level of support to win a majority government. But that's what she did. And so people were shocked that she came out so strongly, but it was a freak of the way that the election statistics work.
What was
out.
It? It was Hudak's mistake?
Hudak's mistake, yeah. He went Mike Harris at the ninth hour in the election, frightened, you know, said he was going to fire a million, you know, civil servants, and, you know, people flipped out. I mean, you look back now and you go, wow, Hudak, I mean, he looks so much more competent than Doug Ford. I mean, the guy looks like he could actually run something and, you know, would be accountable, actually answer questions. Those days are gone. So, I mean, if they couldn't win with a guy like that, and that had the effect, I think, of boosting the Liberals in a number of ridings where they probably weren't going to win. And so that's what people need to remember, is that they were already starting at a kind of deficit. Wynne was never that wildly popular. Now, of course, you had a majority government, and sometimes you can turn that into more support. But the Liberals have difficulty. They're a two-faced party, right? They're facing two directions at once. And that's very difficult, because no matter what you do, you're probably going to make somebody unhappy. I mean, that's Justin Trudeau's challenge, right? And he's another one who got elected with 39% of the popular vote, and he's looking at losses in a whole bunch of areas, absolutely, right? I mean, you can't win any more than all the seats in Atlantic Canada. So next time around, he's probably going to lose some. So it's a challenge, difficult. I mean,
okay, let's get federal just for a second, because I have some questions about, when is it, 2019?
I think so.
Is that it?
I'd have to go and check.
Yeah, 2015 was the last one.
Yep.
Right? So it's somewhere in 2019, October, I think. Is he going to... I read something somewhere that because the Parti Québec, the Bloc is imploding, that the Liberals are going to gain a bunch of seats in Quebec, and that's going to maintain their majority, even though they're losing seats elsewhere. Is that what's going to happen?
You know, it's hard to say because, I mean, it'll depend, of course, on what happens with the NDP. You know, the NDP managed to hang on to a bunch of seats in Quebec, which was absolutely crucial for the future of the federal party. But, you know, now they've put in a leader who has religious headgear, and that doesn't go over well in Quebec. So, I mean, it's really
why is Quebec more racist? And why is it okay? No one talks about it.
I think that for some, it's definitely fueled by an out-and-out racism. For others, it's a legacy of church rule. You know, in Quebec, the church ran the schools, they ran the hospitals, they basically ran everything but urban society right up to the 1960s. And that fueled a very high level of animosity amongst those who were subject to that rule. So, I mean, basically, you took a society that appeared to be very religious, and it just flipped over. Right, it was like a crust on top of the non-religious society that people broke through, and they said, we're never going back. And so that's why you get this strong reaction in Quebec to any kind of religious visibility.
So it's old people?
It's part of the culture. I mean, it's old people, but it's been transmitted down mm-hmm. to a kind of...
But people don't go to church there anymore like they used to.
It's a classic Enlightenment nationalism. Right,
which Enlightenment nationalism.
Yeah, it's sort of the idea that, you know, it's the idea that decisions, particularly political decisions, will be made on the basis of reason, not on the basis of
emotion
or, you know, what we might call tribal affiliations, right? You're a member of the Catholic Church or, you know,
well, you're just a member of Quebec. I mean, it's nation everything there.
But that kind of nationalism is different than because it's supposed to be infused with this idea of reason, right? That we make our decisions based on facts, based on logic. You know, that is supposed to be an advance on the idea that, you know, the Bible says, or any religious book says, that this is what you should do. So that's part of the reaction. And it manifests in negative ways because, frankly, there are a lot of people who are both religious and reasonable. Right? Who can
that always
have,
blows me away.
They can, you know, they have their faith, and yet, you know, yay science. You know, it's yeah. And in a way, it's partly the repudiation of the communitarian side, the community side of the church by the left. You know, there's an old social gospel of the CCF was very much rooted in the church. People who said,
wait,
you know,
the CCF is the party before the NDP.
That's right, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. And
so socialist.
It's absolutely. And yet, what it did was it brought together socialists, it brought together farmers, it brought together, you know, communitarians, all these different groups. So, and there was a very, you know, flexible set of ideas around being in a community. And part of that was religious. Part of that was the church and the people who took from Jesus the idea that, you know, love your brother, take care of each other, you know, the rich aren't going to get through to heaven
that
with all their
union-y.
Stuff.
That sounds union-y.
It does. Now, with the secularization of society, a lot of that old religious leftism has been lost. which is partly why in Quebec, with the kind of nationalism that's emerged there, that, you know, there's no space for that kind of communitarian religious side of progressive politics.
Okay, so staying federally, does it help the Liberals that the PCs seem to have a placeholder for a leader?
You mean Scheer?
Yeah. I mean, he called himself Harper with a smile. Way to go. Great strategy.
Well, this is part of, you know, all the conservative parties are struggling with this, struggling with a membership that wants to drill down into their beliefs. They want a leader who's going to throw them red meat, right? In a way, you know, that excitement that you're talking about, that they want those leaders. Mm-hmm. The problem is those leaders aren't electable. You know, they're not palatable.
Jason Kenney's not electable?
Well, in Alberta, he might be. I mean, I'm kind of hoping he won't be, because I'm kind of hoping that what we're going to see in Alberta is a more normal political alignment, you know, one where there's space for a number of views. I guess we'll see. But certainly at the federal level, people like Kenny and others were limiting the party, limiting its growth. You know, they basically had three elections, and the closest they could get to a majority government, when they did win one, was about 39% of the popular vote. Now, that's not even as good as the two separate right-wing parties. So in other words, this new Conservative Party has not even recouped the popularity of the two separate Conservative parties that existed before.
The United Conservatives...
The old Reform Party and the old Progressive Conservatives.
Oh, you mean, so in the last federal election...
Yeah, well, the last couple of federal elections.
The last couple, when Harper was winning, they never got as many votes as the old
Reform
and what was it? The Alliance and the Tories together?
They changed their name a couple of times.
Okay,
but
I'm just trying to remember all this.
My point is just that if you go back to the old Progressive Conservatives of Brian Mulroney, back to the 80s, right? 80s and 90s. You know, that was a party that could win 48% of the popular vote, 42% of the popular vote. This new Conservative Party is barely scraping 40%. And part of the reason is that they position themselves so far to the right that they're just out of step with Canadian values. And so that's the challenge. But you see, because they let their members directly pick the leader, and they use that to fundraise and do it, you end up with leaders who can't play the game, right? Part of the game is that
How did it used to be?
Well, it used to be that you had delegated conventions, and the people who went to those conventions were people who were a little more experienced in politics and kind of understood the trade-offs and the bending that needs to happen, right? Part of what a conservative leader needs to do is say, you know, hold the horde over here while they reach over and say, hey, centrist voters, why don't you come over here and join our coalition?
And that's just with the Tories, or do all the parties do that now?
It affects the Tories particularly. Because their values are just so extreme, and they've become more extreme over time. It's less so for the NDP in terms of the values, because in fact, often NDP values are more popular than the party itself. And that's true of the left around the world, right? The left-wing policies are often more popular than left-wing parties. But the problem for the left is that they face uneven reaction from the media. So it's harder for them to get a fair shake. And then you've got the Liberals in the center, and the Liberals are the ultimate in, well, flexible party. That's a nice term for it. The other is unprincipled. They stretch across a very broad swath of voters, right? From economic liberals on the right to social justice liberals on the left. And that means that they can gain voters from both, but they can also lose voters to both.
Do people vote for their MPP? Or do they vote for the leader of the party?
No one votes the local member.
No.
No. I mean, that's just one of the abiding myths that's promoted by the members themselves, who have a vested interest in letting you think that, you know, I'm working very hard for you as your local member. And, of course, they are. I'm not saying that politicians don't work hard, because they do, and I wouldn't want that job. Attending a meeting five nights a week and, you know, listening to all kinds of, you know, different ideas from people who may or may not know anything about politics. You know, I don't want that job. It's hard work. But people vote party. And there's a very good reason for that. It's hard to be informed, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to figure out from the Byzantine complexity that is politics. And government is complicated. You know, running a government and providing services and trying to make sure there's accountability and value for money, that's all hard and complicated. That's why there's expertise. And the voters can't possibly become informed in all the particular details of each individual person. I mean, it's why at the municipal level, voter turnout's lower, much lower. Because without parties, people can't figure out what's going on. And it means they can't hold anyone accountable.
Right. So at the municipal level, you're just voting on pure personality.
Well, there are subtle cues. I mean, I think most people knew that Rob Ford was on the right. Most people know that Joe Mihaljevic is on the left. Right? I mean, people get this. And part of the cues come through because you'll see politicians at other levels endorse them. Right, so you'll see, you know, the Liberal MPP is here with so-and-so, local riding, you know, local councillor. And so people who are paying attention will use that as a way of figuring out, okay, who are these people? Who should I vote for?
What does Justin do with, what has he done? Normally, would he have been campaigning for her?
Well, one would have expected, yeah, federal. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, in a way, the prime minister is the elite, you know, the top level. And, you know, sometimes the prime minister doesn't want to kind of soil his hands, you know, getting involved in other jurisdictions. And it is complicated because the coalitions for different parties are different at different levels. So, for instance, in British Columbia, the Liberal Party is a right-wing party.
Yeah.
Right? It's the right-wing party.
Yeah, he would never be seen with Christy Clark.
And yet Christy Clark is a federal Liberal. Right, she is a federal Liberal, and I was on her show when she was on CKNW. She had a talk show, and I was on it many times when she wanted someone to talk about how Michael Ignatieff wasn't finished, and you know people were beating up on him, and I was saying, well, yeah, actually, I mean there does seem to be a bit of a Tory-driven media beat up on Ignatieff, and I'm always against people getting in the way of the public making the choices, and you know I tell my students, look, polling is not a reflection of what people want. It's designed to get the result. You know, millions of dollars are spent on polls to try to convince you you can't have what you want, and you should take what we're offering. So,
right. And yet, the only explanation that comes with polls makes no sense to anyone who hasn't taken a university-level course in it.
Yeah.
This poll is correct.
19 times out of 20. Yeah.
80% of the time or whatever. Yeah. It's like, what does that even mean? Can we talk polls for a minute and how to read them?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a very sophisticated methodology that pollsters use. And basically the idea is, look, you've got an electorate of, what, millions of people. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't go and ask each one of them what they're going to do. That it would take too long. It'd be too expensive. So what you try to do, the idea behind polling is, if we can construct a sample of that larger group.
What's a good sample size?
Well, again, you know, there's lots of debate.
I read a poll yesterday, and it was 908.
You know, there are pollsters.
That does not seem like a great sample size.
Pollsters will tell you, as long as it is representative of the broader group, the results will have some meaning.
So that means what? Like
it
they
means
call
that
people
it, that you need,
up
it,
and down the province?
Look, we know from the census that there's X number of old people, and X number of rich old people, and X number of poor old people. And so the point about polling is, you've got to make sure that you're actually, your snapshot is a reflection of the larger group. And, you know, where polling goes wrong is when it's not. So, for instance, in British Columbia in the 2013 election, all the polls were saying the NDP were ahead by 9 points. But on election day, they lost by 6 points. Whoa, what happened? Well, what happened was that the polling was oversampling young people who are not reliable voters.
So they didn't even come. They didn't even come and vote.
They didn't come and vote. And it undersampled old people who are really reliable voters. So that's, you know, that's when that happens, then the polling goes askew. But often polling is very accurate. I mean, polling, particularly just before election day, you know, is often very, very good, except when things go wrong.
So what do you think is going to happen in the next 2 weeks?
What we're going to see, well, I mean, part of the challenge is if it were just a case that the NDP were coming up in the polls and looking good, it'd be a pylon, right? The media would just start beating them up ferociously. And, it'd, you know, the accusations and the headlines would become more extreme, right? You know, she's for gulags, you know, whatever, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter what's true. It only matters what people believe is true. And but the problem is there's no credible alternative. That's the problem. I mean, boo-hoo, I feel bad for the media because they've got no exit strategy this time. They can't rush into the arms of Wynn because, one, well, they haven't really liked what she's done so far, and two, her polling just looks not credible, right? She's sitting in the basement. And then they're having a difficult time getting their head around, how do we make excuses for Doug Ford? How do we do it? We, You know, they just they want to believe that they are credible, intelligent people who are driven by facts and argument and track record. And this guy is not giving them anything to work off of. So I mean, I don't know where they're going to go with this, right? If the numbers continue to improve for the Democrats, I mean, in the end, they may just throw up their hands and say, you know what, we're going to have to sit out the next 4 years.
But now, do you say the media is tends to lean towards the right economically and apologize for the Tories? The Toronto Star is a left wing newspaper. So is the Globe.
It's no the Globe. No? Come on. I mean, you know, this is comedy, right? No. I mean, the Star is Canada's only liberal newspaper. Okay, so in that sense, they embody the same biases as the Liberals do as a party, right? That they tend to be fairly left-wing on social issues, but fairly right-wing on economic issues. I mean, don't forget, it was Paul Martin, right, the finance minister for Jean Chrétien, who pushed our deficit reduction way further than the Conservatives under Morley ever dreamed of doing, right? So in that way, you know, the Liberals are quite nimble. You know, they can leap back and forth. But because they have such strong links to Bay Street, the corporate center of Canada, they never go that far into left-wing economic policies unless there's some pretty serious stuff happening. Usually it means a threat from the left. So, you know, our newspapers, if we go across the country or we look at the chains, they're owned by fairly vicious right-wing corporations. And the right-wing bias is confirmed by a mountain of what we call content analysis, where academics go through and they look at, okay, well, how many times do they endorse this? And how do they talk about this? And it's just so obvious, right, that the newspapers do not reflect the opinions that Canadians have, right?
Right. Now, the Globe endorsed who in 2015 federally?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to go back and check. I mean, I'm pretty sure they endorsed Harper. I mean, they've been pretty reliable.
Even then?
Yep.
Even when it was clear?
Like, you know, the Globe and Mail. And again, you know, I mean, for the media, the Liberals and the Conservatives are not nearly as different as they pretend they are, you know, in terms of, again, their reliability from a business and corporate standpoint. From a business and corporate standpoint, these two parties are trustable. You know, they get it.
Yeah.
They understand that business people should be in charge and that, you know, taxes should be low. I mean, you know, there's differences, right? The Conservatives, the tax is going to be a little lower. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to characterize the difference between the Liberals and Conservatives here in Ontario that, you know, the problem with Mike Harris was not that Ontarians were against cutting programs and, you know, cutting taxes. The problem was Mike Harris enjoyed it too much. You know, he enjoyed, you know, kicking poor people in the teeth. And that's not right. You know, yes, we're going to cut your programs, but you know what? I'm going to feel bad about it. And tonight, I'm going to have some cheap Chardonnay instead of the good stuff. Right? Like, it's that kind of liberalism that, you know, they're not really, at the end of the day, they're going to make excuses for why they can't do whatever the economic thing is that we need to do to help the poor or education, but they're going to feel bad about it.
God, I wish I could say that I wasn't one of those champagne socialists, but I think I am. I took something on CBC Poll Tracker website where, what was it called? The Voter Compass?
Oh, Voter Compass, yeah.
Yeah, and I came up liberal, and I've never voted liberal.
Right.
And I just, and so I wonder what that sort of disconnect speaks to. Like there's one idea, that there's the idea that you have of yourself, and then there's the truth.
Well, I mean, it just depends on how you add things up. And things like Vote Compass, you know, they try to put a number to what are often very nebulous values.
That's
and
true.
It can produce ridiculous results.
It for sure. I mean, I'm self-employed. So any time that there was a question about corporate tax rate, well, I'm incorporated. I'd like it to be. I'm fine with that being lower.
Yeah.
But I think they were talking about big corporations that seem to be getting away with things.
Well, I mean, you know, corporations benefit from roads and infrastructure and, in an economic system that is organized in a way that facilitates their wealth creation. And part of the bargain in classical liberal theory is that they should pay some of the costs of that infrastructure because, after all, they're using it, right? And part of the critique from the left is that what we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years is, you know, consistently, corporate welfare, handouts to the mm-hmm. powerful, with the idea and the argument is that, well, if you give them the breaks, then they'll take the money that you're not taking from them.
Sure.
They'll put it back into job creation.
They will. Trickle down. It works wonders.
Except that it hasn't, of course.
Except that altruism has never been a part of the taking care of shareholders.
And, you know, the most generous people are the people who have the least. And the studies of the poor and working people, you know, in terms of the percentage of their actual income or money or disposable wealth, they are the most generous people. You know, the myth of the wealthy, you know, generous person is just that. It's a myth.
Okay, second to last question. What happens if Kathleen Wynne is responsible for her party losing official party status? How does that happen, and what does it mean for the liberals in this province?
Well, you know, it's pretty arbitrary. Well, you know, what does official party status mean? It's an arbitrary number, you know, in the legislature, a certain, you know, number. And what it means is that the party loses resources. So by having this official party moniker, you get money from the legislature to hire people to work in your office, to help do research for you. I mean, the things that would help you to play this role that they're supposed to play, right? This romantic idea of the local member. So that's what it would affect if the party fell below party standing. And then what would happen is they would go in and they would try to get the other parties to agree to lower the number of seats to be recognized officially as a party. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So
it's no big deal. This happens all the time.
That's no big deal. That's not the issue.
Incredible.
No, it's no big deal. Okay. But the issue for the Liberals, of course, and for Wynne personally, is that she'll have to step down, right, as leader. I mean, that's absolutely given. If she loses her seat, that makes it even easier.
Well, speaking of stepping down, why did Tom Mulcair take so long to step down?
Well, Tom Mulcair, you know, man, talk about a guy who just misplayed his cards.
Sure did.
I mean, you know, he was put in as leader in part to try to solidify the breakthrough in Quebec for the NDP. And I get that, right? I mean, Mulcair...
Because he spent a lot of time in Quebec?
Well, he's from Quebec. He's from Quebec, and he was a former environment minister in the Liberal provincial government.
Charest's.
I'm not sure if it was Charest's, but it was one of the Liberal governments. And so, I mean, for the NDP to make this guy their leader is... I mean, it was pretty shocking in many ways, but it made sense. And the party and all the party members basically said, you know what, we got to do this because we've got to show Quebec that we're serious about being a Quebec party. But it didn't work. And so he didn't make the breakthrough for all kinds of reasons. And then he misplayed his hand at the convention. Now, one thing that happens in the NDP is that it is a very party-oriented party, very organized. You know, you go into a convention, the leadership gets its ducks in a row. You know, you're going to go there with something, but you know before you get there that you're going to win because you're going to organize to make sure people get to that convention to support what you're doing. Mulcair came from a much more leader-oriented kind of party where the leader strolls in and everybody bows down to them. Well, that's not the NDP. And so he came into the convention expecting to have his leadership reaffirmed and found himself booted as the leader. But the problem then was, what would the party do? You don't want to have a situation where you don't have a leader. And certainly the party was still concerned about the optics of this for Quebec. So leaving Mulcair as the leader was kind of a consolation prize. In the end, you know, was it the right decision? I don't know.
It's weird when those sorts of oversights happen at such a high level. That there wasn't somebody in his ear going, "This is a bad idea, Tom."
It's surprising, isn't it?
With all those brains?
It is very surprising. But, you know, I mean, from what I've heard, and all I've heard is, you know, what I hear, is that Mulcair was very much his own man, and he was going to do things his way. And whereas the tradition of the party in the NDP is a much more collective one. And, you know, even they've never been a leadership-dominant party. In fact, until the 80s, they never ran a leadership-focused campaign. It was always issue-based. Hmm. So you go back in the, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, it's never, the leader's just the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the party is the party, and that's what they're selling.
Has that done them a disservice? Because they can't run on any cult of personality or charisma or...
I mean, personally, I think that politics that's based around leadership identities is a pretty weak form of politics.
Yet it happens all the time.
It does, because it's basic advertising, right? It's branding.
Mm-hmm.
You swap out the leader, brand new party.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that the New Democrats and before them CCF survived was because they did actually represent something. Right, they're not just an empty vessel into which you could put any policies,
right,
which is much more the other parties. And that was their ballast, their anchor, part of their ability to survive in a media environment that was completely hostile to them. Right? I mean, go back and read the positive column inches. There's hardly any. But they could survive because there were these people who said, you know what, I'm for you because you're for us.
Yeah.
Right? You're our party. Yeah. You represent what we are and what we believe.
Okay, last question. This Ford Nation business, is it a blip or is democracy under attack in this country? Does Canada go the way America goes?
I mean, no. We're not going to go the way America goes because they have a congressional system and we have a parliamentary system, and those create different pressures for certain kinds of behavior. And so the openings in America for this kind of populist temper tantrum is much greater than in Canada, where there does need to be some coherency to actually govern and vie for power. And so that, in a sense, disciplines these people. You know, they can be there, but then the coalition's got to get to a certain size to win. And the more that those people are acting out, the harder it is, as we're seeing with Doug Ford, to hold that coalition together. I mean, populism runs both ways. It's a left-wing and a right-wing thing. And part of what you started off by saying, well, how come it's just Doug Ford? Why isn't there a left-wing populist? Part of what we're seeing is people reacting. They're not really right-wingers. They're just reacting to Doug and Rob Ford, who they are identifying with on a personal level, which is a bad way to do politics. But that's where they're at. And part of the challenge for other parties is that they're not seen as authentic by the people who need the politics. You know, the average Joes and Joinas, you know, the people who don't have a college education. That group is waiting to be mobilized, and damn, they're mad as hell, and they don't want to take it. And so then when someone like this guy comes along, some of them will fall for it. They'll go for it. But the rest just fall out. They just disappear from the electorate.
So you're not worried?
Well, I think, you know, I am worried to the extent that things are being said that I thought, you know, weren't able to be said. Right, we've got people who are saying things, particularly nice middle class liberals. We're seeing this in academe, the return of anti-democratic liberalism. So, you know, liberals who are like, you know what, the great unwashed are stupid and they shouldn't be allowed to vote. You know, it should just be us smart people. You know, whoa, that's really scary to see that return.
I want you to come back on and we can talk Jordan Peterson then.
Ooh, yes, very good.
Dennis, thanks so much.
Oh,
great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.